I'm introducing Victoria Lee, is a London-based artist, writer, and visual poet, a graduate of the Royal College of Art, and is co-founder of Arc Editions with Sam Winston and Karen Blights. She is the co-editor of The New Concrete, an anthology of visual and concrete poetry in the 21st century. That features 100 artists and writers who, like her, work across a variety of disciplines such as art, poetry, graphics, and literature. Her talk is entitled Flag.
My artist book, and actually art career, starts with Ronald King. And in 1988, he moved next door to us. He actually moved his present to literally the next door house where I lived. And we introduced ourselves. And Ron has a lot of coincidences that happened in his life, which he can tell, you know, he's already told lots of stories about. But it turns out that he and my husband grew up in Rio as children, went to the same English school as children, and then were sent as young, very young boys to the same boarding school in England from Rio. And they actually shared the same headmaster. So then he moved to Toronto, where I was born in the same year I was born, and his children were born in the same hospital I was born. So we had these interconnections. And the night before I left for Codex, the phone rang, and I was really busy, and it was Ron, and I thought, I've got to talk to him for ages. And he said, "Hello, how are you?" And he said, "Could you help me with something?" And I said, "I'm really sorry, I'm flying the next day." So he said, "Oh, I'll go speak to Karen, I'll do it, get it done." And I said, "Ron, can you remember something?" I said, "How are you?" And he said, "Oh, I'm decrepit and old, and I've got a really bad memory." And I said, "Well, can you remember when we first met? Was I at Camberwell or not?" And he went, "Don't you remember? I came into your kitchen, you showed me something, and it was so bad that I said, I didn't want to be too rude, so I said, well, maybe you should do a course." I have no memory of that conversation, what I showed him. I just know I ended up at Camberwell within a couple of weeks doing a BA, working in his studio, and then going to the Royal College of Art, and that is because of Ron. Didn't know about that till the night before we left. Anyway, next slide. So, cycling through my years at Circle Press, ruining his presses, I was very bad with impacting on his roles, and he used to be very patient but get quite cross. And I went through letterpress stages and sort of digital printing stages, and the sense of perfection, I'm quite messy, but I always got disappointed if something was, you know, buckled or bent or smudged, and it was sort of like a physical pain. I always thought, oh, I can't sell this, or I'm going to have to drop the price because there's a dent. And then I discovered typewriters, and the fact that it doesn't matter if you make a mistake, and the mistakes are part of the sort of the feeling, and they're very valid. And they're quite restricted with what you're doing, so you have to be quite imaginative with the restriction of just having that sort of that typeface and that mark and that spacing, and you have to, from there, you have to sort of grow it. And I started researching The New Concrete, working with a librarian in London at the Poetry Library, and we both came up with an idea to do an anthology of concrete poetry as seen today. And we wanted to include the original, as many original artists as we could possibly, and plus the sort of the new work that we were seeing everywhere. And Chris McCabe, who's my co-editor, he collects concrete poetry, he collects our work, he collects all the artist books in London. And his knowledge is phenomenal about this subject, and I approached it with virtually just sort of catching the odd glimpse of what concrete poetry history was, and I realised I knew nothing, so I just set about years researching it, and it was so confused and what's the word when it's contradictory? Everyone's story was different, and they said they started here, and it was me, and it was that, and it was such a sort of a messy history that I decided to just try and do a linear, you know, bit by bit, and just get all the information, and then just literally see where it went. And the most interesting thing about the movement of contribute poetry was the geography of it. It started in Brazil 1 minute, at the same minute post-war it started in Switzerland, and they didn't know they were doing the same sort of work until they started flying over and meeting each other. And then there are certain key figures that took the work and went round the world. And that's how it grew. So I did a map that features the sort of central lines, the geography in red with the typewriter. And I caught up to speak with Chris, and we carried on with the book. We split it 50-50, went on to 50 artists each, and we had a sort of a 2 or 3 year building this book, and it was a pleasure working with him. So the sort of varying responses from the artists, the more well-known they were, the more they were gracious and helpful. And there were some times where there were some rude responses, and there'd be a sort of relationship we'd just have to brace ourselves for. And one of them was as an artist, and I emailed him, and we kept wanting to have different work from him, which is quite a tricky subject to have. Eventually I said, oh, I wonder if we could see this, and he just sent an email back saying, who you? There's a diary entry. I kept a diary, through most of the times, but Chris and I finally had the book in our hands, and it was a dummy piece, and we were sitting in a meeting room, and we were about to open it, and we were in the South Bank Centre, and someone moved us out, so we went behind the scenes and sat on the stairs looking at the book. We opened it, and the glue binding started to pull at different bits, and Chris was behind me. And then something just dropped down the stairs, and we had this brand new book, and things seemed to be falling apart. But it was something else, and that just sort of marked the end of this book for me, and the beginning of it, you know, the journey of it into the world. And I'm sorry about this, but I haven't actually told anyone this, but Eugene Gumringer wrote to me and about something, and he said these were his words, that, you know, he said it's still about this is the grandfather of concrete poetry. He was one of the founders in Switzerland, and he's had, you know, we were looking at his anthologies for research, and he contributed his work to us, but we had to sort of, we sent him 2 copies of this book, and it wasn't until he was talking about something else, and he said that, you know, he said these very nice words, which sort of sealed the sort of 3 years hard work that Chris and I did. Anyway, so I talked about the typewriters and the new lease of life, where I could make mistakes. And I just thought, what could I do with it? So I decided to retype someone's book, and I picked E. Cummings because I liked his poetry. And I took the book apart and then put it back into the typewriter and just typed it. Typed each poem until it fell off the page, and it didn't matter if it did. And it created sort of new work sort of on the right-hand side. But the experience of typing was like, typing his work, reading it and typing it, and doing his spacing and his punctuation and his spelling was the experience. I was standing in his shoes doing it, and I could see why, you know, why he suddenly thought, oh, I'm just going to end it here or do this. And it was a labour of love. I think I retyped it 3 times, and I had to take my typewriter on holiday with me and sometimes just sit and retype sort of 3 books worth of his poem and then rewind them. So that was Codex 15, and then another Codex comes, and I've got a new project to think about doing. And I went to Tate Modern and just wandered around, and there was a very small room with Louise Bourgeois stuff in it. there was this sculptor, and she'd been making things from her family's clothes and just sort of repurposing them into, you know, all sorts of things. And it was such a sort of powerful image that I went home and I thought, I wonder how I can just sort of, you know, capture the day and see if I can take these fabrics and make them flat again. So I got the typewriter out and started creating a check out of that. So this is actually what I'm doing is probably revealing quite a lot behind my work, which, you know, is like the back scenes that which will be quite explicit. So so I thought, how can I use these checks in some new work and also bring writers into it, because if I wanted to continue the Cummings sort of writer based work. So I started looking at writers I liked and seeing if they wore checks, and Joe Dillon luckily did. Hemingway had hundreds, and Steinbeck had hundreds. And I think that's a very grand picture of a check here. So I reproduced these checks with using the typewriter. And it was like printing, you know, again. So the E. Cummings experience was just like music with his poetry, and this one is just like a loom. You go line by line by line by line. And it was like sort of knitting or weaving a poem. Anyway, so that was Czech. So this is Codex 2019, I think. Yeah, so what do I do? Let's take Czech and move it on. And I thought, I wonder if I could take the characters from the 50 writers that I've featured with all their checks and find the characters in their book and see if I can, you know, do something with their clothes. But people don't write about clothes in the same detail. I kept looking and it was just, she's wearing a skirt, he's wearing something. There's no detail I could pick on. So what did I do? I know. I thought I'll take one writer and take his books and then just see what's going to happen with the typewriter. So I picked Thomas Hardy as one of them. Hardy is my maiden name, and this is my father's business card from the 1960s. And it turns out he was an advertising manager for typewriters. And I remember, and I didn't realise this until I'd been at my mum's last year and sort of looking through a few things. And I can remember as a child sort of 60s commercials with typewriters and things, and it sort of suddenly hit me that you do this sort of, you do this circular thing in life where you end up something back at the origin. So so I thought, well, that's good. I should get myself a good Olivetti. So Thomas Hardy, I loved his work anyway, and I'm going to read about him now, reading that. So he grew up among the working class people that he wrote about, and he took on the role of mediator between the rural life and the educated classes who read his stories in London. So he grew up in Dorset, saw the sort of poverty around him and who was working in the fields and what they were wearing and what life was like for them. But he also lived in London and was writing serials in the newspapers for people. So he says he believed his novels could bring about social change. So I took Far From the Money Crowd. This is really behind the scenes. The new work I've done, which you'll see on my table, starts with a Kindle. It's got something called X-ray on it, where you can just see a bar. You can see where the characters appear. And I just thought, oh, that's something I might like to use. So I did. And Kate at Letterform Archive came around yesterday, and she said, that's book DNA, those images I've created. And I said, I'm going to use that, but I'll also say that you said it rather than claiming it. So these lines indicate, every line represents a page where a character has been. So we've got four characters in Far From the Madding Crowd: Bathsheba, Troy, Boldwood, Oak, and, well, that's it, that's four. And so each line and where they appear is represented. And so you have the overlap when Hardy's written about all four characters on the same page. So it's a sort of a journey and a narrative through the book. And then I thought the strongest bit of the story, the bit that fascinated me, was Sergeant Troy, who was this sort of dashing soldier, but that Bathsheba, was he was the only one she really fell in love with, and he was he betrayed her. But he was represented in the book as this red coat that you just saw in the distance. It was just like a flash of red through the trees, and it just represented danger. And I thought their love story would make another good, you know, take that narrative out and do a separate piece. This is Bathsheba in grey, and then Troy in red, and when it's sort of browny, that's where they're on the same page together. So that's their relationship through the book. That's my typewriter. I take a lot of pictures of my typewriter. So after this piece of work, I'd read two or three more of his novels, but there's nothing that didn't have the same sort of meat to it as Far From the Madding Crowd and Tess. So I picked Tess of the D'Urbervilles. And what I learned was he wrote this book because when he was about 16 in Dorset, he watched a woman get hanged. She'd murdered her husband, and the husband was abusive, and you know, she'd killed him. And Thomas Hardy watched the hanging, and it had always stayed with him. And he said it was something he regretted watching because it had made such an impact. And he built the story of Tess around the fact. So I started to break the book down. I wanted to see how to reappropriate the narrative from, you know, a different way. And I thought there are a lot of colours in this book, and maybe I'll just do something about, you know, the colours. But the more I sort of worked with that, the more I realised that the clothes were the most important bit about the book, because her story went from rags to riches to rags to riches to you know, the death flag. And again, when I started to research, a lot of people have written about Hardy and how he uses clothes, and he's quite unique with the amount of description he has about the clothes and the details and what everyone's wearing and why it's important that he's showing us what they're wearing at certain times. So he says it reveals social class, aspiration, moods, other abstract concepts. And fashion and literature is often overlooked, but it's important as the setting, and it's crucial in this fiction. Because he wants to challenge the traditional gender and class associations. So the story of Tess, I'm going to do it in about 140 characters, like Twitter, because of the time. Actually, Tess had a good A and a bad A after her, and the story is about how she is raped by bad A, falls in love with good A, who discovers bad A, dumps her, bad A comes after her again, and good A turns up to rescue her, she kills bad A, and then she gets hanged. So this is, I'm going to actually be, I've got 3 minutes left. So doing the research and seeing what the influences were, I looked at Louise Bourgeois again, and her cloth book, and checks in a cloth book. And then another book I'd done about 8 years ago that Roberto has got in Stanford. I don't think anyone's seen it, really. It's called Bang Bang, and it's a story about rape. Rape as a weapon of war. And it's a poem I wrote. And I sewed it in Helvetica, and I don't know how I did it, but I did it. I don't think I can do it again. And then this is more research, which is there's a dedicated Thomas Hardy data base with his clothes and people collecting all the mentions of his clothes in the novels. There's real Thomas Hardy clothes in the museum, little scraps that he's got from his family. And then it was my turn to start looking for fabrics, and I went to Soho, which is in the centre of London and sort of where all the theatres are. So the sort of the feathers and the glitter and the sequins and the beautiful silks, and I went there and started to buy all the clothes that had been mentioned. And she went from sort of coarse muslin to working cottons to silk when she was with Goodet, then her wedding dress when she was with Goodet, and then back into the working clothes when he left her, and then into cashmere, actually, when she was back with Bade at the end. And so built the book around this. And I got David Henning from Henning Family Press, who's done quite a lot of work with us, to do the binding for me. And he just embraced it immediately. He said, right, I'm going to do a 19th century binding, and I'm going to use vellum, and I'll use the ribbons to bind the book. So the materials are literally the materials of the story. There's nothing more in that book other than what's featured in the book. The sort of the vellum represents her time as a dairy herd. And then there's a red and white theme in all of Thomas Hardy's books. And they represent purity and danger. And especially with Tess, she's always in a white dress, and there's always red is the sign of danger. You know, bad A cigars got a red glare to it. This is a quote from David who bound it, who said, I'm going to layer the silks. The ribbons are part of the binding here. And this is a review I found in the British Library when he first published it. That little bookmark represents the point at which her life changes when she's raped, and that's the only marker in the book where the narrative is pointed out. And that's a little quote from that. So I can hear the I can hear my alarm going off.
You can finish.
Okay. So that's the red woman. She's first noted by she's first distinguished by every other girl in a white muslin dress because she's wearing a red ribbon, and that's the sort of the theme that goes through the whole book. And then there's always these portents that Hardy writes about, which is the sort of, you know, future trouble to come. And then at the very end, she gets hanged, like the person that he saw when he was 16. And the in the back of the book is David made a flag, which is in the same proportion as the flag, and it's got tabs, which you can fly with. And that's it. That's